Around here, it's pretty typical to pronounce the letter A much more nasally if it comes before the letter N. I'll give you some examples. Cat versus can't. Hat versus hand. Do you hear it? Here, I'll let an expert do it.
I say cat, but I say can't, where my tongue is much more raised. You can say hat, but you say hand.
That's Mary Kahn at K-State. She's part of a linguistics team that's discovered a new accent in liberal Kansas. The town is pretty close to Texas, and the Spanish accent folks are bringing with them to liberal is transforming the way everyone speaks English there.
You get hat, and you get hand. You get Spanish. You get cat, and you get can't.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to hear about how the Spanish accent is becoming the Kansas accent.
You have all these Spanish speakers that have that Spanish twang and that whole sound with it. And then if people that speak English are around a lot of that, I could imagine the English speaker will start to sound like the Hispanic.
So we're going to hear about this new Kansas accent in the town of Liberal today on KCUR's Central Standard. We're joined by Trevin Garcia with the Kansas Speaks Project at K-State. Hi, Trevin.
Hello.
What is Kansas Speaks?
So Kansas Speaks is something that Mary started here at K-State, where we basically go all over Kansas and try to document how people in Kansas are talking, since Kansas is kind of in between all of these different linguistic areas and hasn't been as well studied for a while. So
when you say between,
we're just here to study.
When you say in between all of these different linguistic areas, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so like Kansas is kind of in between an area like with the southern accent, and then in between an area where there's a more Midwest type of accent they would hear in like Ohio or places like that, and then also with the West and the way people in California kind of talk.
What inspired you to want to research how the Spanish accent is changing speech in liberal Kansas? Do you have a personal connection to this?
Yeah, I grew up in liberal for most of my life, since about the time I was in fourth grade. So about when I was 10-ish, I've been growing up in liberal. And so growing up there, I noticed a couple of different things that whenever I went to go visit my family in Emporia, I didn't necessarily hear them using. And so being aware of that, when I got the chance to do a linguistics study at K-State, I was like, hey, liberal would be really interesting to study.
What was it that you heard in liberal that you didn't hear in Emporia?
It was the stuff that you brought up earlier with the A, and then I'd also speak in a way that sounded a little bit faster than what my mom's side of the family were using. And so kind of off of that, I was like, hey, we should do something with this.
So wait, people are fast talkers in liberal?
They have, so the rhythm that they have in liberal follows or is a lot closer to the rhythm that Spanish speakers use. It's more of a staccato sound, whereas with English, it's more of a not less rhythmatic.
Can you give some demonstrations maybe of how you would say the same sentence rhythmically in a different way in liberal versus Emporia, Kansas?
I sure can try. So with the English in liberal, like I said, it's going to be the syllables are going to be a lot closer to each other in length. So the example that I kind of like to use is really as opposed to really, like where one of the syllables is very noticeably a lot longer than the rest.
Wait, will you do that again? I didn't hear the difference.
Oh, so it's like really as opposed to really.
Oh.
Where that first part is a lot more drawn out.
So in liberal, they would say more really, and then in...
Yeah.
In Emporia, they'd be like, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I'm getting it, but doesn't that depend somewhat on just like what people are talking about and the emotion they're bringing to it? Because if I go, really, I think that to me is like I'm almost being sarcastic.
Yeah, that's just the easiest example it is for me to do. Since growing up in liberal, I, you know, have this language change, and so sometimes it's a little bit harder for me to really figure out how to make it sound different.
Yeah, well, okay, so. Tell me more about your background before we get into the details of the study. I mean, you said that you came to Liberal when you were 10. Where were you born?
I was actually born in Emporia. So my mom grew up there, was born there. So I was 2. And then my dad grew up in Mexico, in central Mexico. And so being a mixed race person like that, I always have to be like a little bit more aware of the kind of language that I'm using around the different people that I'm using in order to fit in, basically.
Did you grow up speaking Spanish in your home?
Yeah, with my dad especially. And my mom knows Spanish now too. But when I was like around kindergarten, preschool, first grade, I was actually put in ESL for a couple of years. Not because I didn't know English, but because I was just speaking Spanish so much. They thought, oh, he only knows Spanish. And so I got thrown into ESL.
When you talk about being very aware of how you speak, I mean, I feel like you're starting to get at that a little bit. But growing up, I mean, how did that awareness make you feel?
I don't really know the best way to express it. But when you're aware of how you have to talk around people in order to fit in, you automatically kind of become more aware of the different subtle things you have to do in order to sound a specific way. So like the difference between sounding like someone who has grown up in Kansas their whole lives and has like that Kansas accent, as opposed to someone who has grown up in Hispanic communities and knows how to sound Hispanic.
So what were the kinds of things at a really young age that you found yourself doing to, I mean, for lack of a better phrase, basically like you're talking about code switching, that you could switch back and forth. What were the things you would do, and who would you do those things around?
So the easiest way to do it is to talk about how, so my mom's side of the family is very white, and my dad's side of the family is very Hispanic. And so figuring out basically how to talk white, like not necessarily how you would talk in like a professional setting, but when people are trying to sound like they're white, they usually end up sounding and using like more professional, with air quotes around it, type of language use. So that's going to be things like with the Spanish accents, a lot of times you'll hear a dentalization of the TH sound. So instead of hearing that, they'll use dat or something along those lines. And that happens with a lot of TH sounds as well.
And so at a really young age, you were noticing that and being aware of which TH sound you were using?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, the demographics of Liberal, I mean, I'm not sure about Emporia. I don't know a lot about that. But the demographics of Liberal have changed a lot over the years. And you were talking about feeling like you didn't fit in for having this Spanish-speaking background. But it sounds like that is becoming a lot more common.
Oh, yeah. I know in our study we talk about how, so the Hispanic population of Liberal in 1980 was about 20%, a little bit less. But in 2010, when we have our last census data available, the Hispanic population Liberal was 60%. And so it's grown a lot just over the last couple decades.
So what are the, so how has that affected the accent in Liberal? I mean, it sounds like it's moving beyond there's a specific community that talks a certain way to this is just how everyone talks in Liberal.
So it's getting to the point where, like, if you're growing up in Liberal, that's how you're going to talk. A lot of the older folks in Liberal won't have this kind of accent, just because once you're out of school and you're only talking to like a smaller group of people, that's who you're going to sound like for the most part. But when you're in school, in order to fit in, you want to sound like the people that you want to sound like your peers that you're going to school with. And so there's a lot of accent mixing and change that's happening in your school years. And so if you grow up going to school in liberal, you're going to have this accent that we find in liberal.
Can you sort of talk to me more about the traits of the accent? Because we've talked about the A sound that comes before an N sound. What exactly is that coming from in Spanish?
That's just how they pronounce that in Spanish, at its simplest. But so that pre-nasal ash is what it is, or that's what we call it. But when it comes to like this pre-nasal ash sound, it's a lot closer to how they pronounce it in Spanish. But what we're finding in liberal is that it's about halfway between how it's pronounced in English and how it's pronounced in Spanish. And so it's at like this really interesting intermediate kind of form between the two languages.
Can you demonstrate what we're talking about again in case people have just tuned in since our demonstration earlier in the show?
Yeah. So that's the difference between Spanish and Spanish, or had and hand, can and can't.
And then what would be a word, one word in English pronounced kind of what you would have called in a Kansas accent at some point, but that you would, and then pronounced how in what you would now call a liberal accent, the accent of the town of Liberal, Kansas.
So in that little sound clip that you played earlier with one of the people that we interviewed, he pronounces Hispanic in the way that we expect someone from liberal to. And so,
which is how?
Hispanic.
So like, eh.
Yeah, like your mouth tends to be, or at least when I think of it, it tends to be a lot more open.
So what is, and then what is what you're starting to notice as the liberal Kansas version of that word?
Oh, that one was, sorry, I didn't super understand. But yeah, in liberal, you're usually going to have a lot more open pronunciation of it.
So that would be Hispanic versus Hispanic?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay.
Again, like since I grew up there, it's a little bit hard for me to make really good differentiations between the two.
Is there, I mean, tell me about the people you interviewed for your research. You just mentioned this guy who we heard from.
Mm-hmm. So when I did my interviews, it started with people that I had gone to school with. So a lot of people were my age that people had already known for years. And then I expanded from there, since we needed a lot more people to interview so we can get data. I went to the high school and asked if I could pull a couple people out of class and get them to sign permission slips so that I could interview them. And so the school was really cooperative with that. And so thanks to them, I was able to get a lot of really good interviews with people who were just about to graduate.
What would you say are like the personal stories that people were telling you that started looking like trends that might be related to this changing accent?
I think the biggest, or at least the most interesting to us as researchers, was that there wasn't a lot of segregation happening, like not really anything that we were seeing in the schools. Hispanic people were friends with the white people, and then everyone was just friends with everyone, which is really great to see. And is a big part of why everyone, even if they have a Spanish-speaking background or not, are speaking in this new accent.
So like the friendships, you're noticing that friendship is actually reflected in the way people are speaking.
Yeah.
That's such a cool idea.
Yeah, it's really great to see something like that.
I mean, is that not what you experienced when you were growing up there?
No, it's definitely something that I experienced, just given how, again, everyone is talking with everyone. And so it's just really great to see that continuing even after I've, and getting stronger as I've put more years between myself and going to school in Liberal.
What's been the response in the community to hearing about a changing accent, and a changing accent that's been highly influenced by an immigrant community?
In Liberal, the response has been pretty good. They put up the K-State news release in the paper, and a lot of my friends and people from Liberal were sharing it around on like Facebook and other places like that. But of course, there's with people outside of Liberal, I saw that they published the K-State news release in the Wichita newspaper, the Wichita Eagle, and some of the comments on there were not as great. But a lot of
like
that
what, has, along what lines? What did people get sort of political with that?
Yeah, a little bit. Some of them misinterpreted Liberal, like the Liberal accent, as Liberal the ideology and not Liberal Kansas. And so a little confusion there. But a lot of them were also talking about how Spanish is ruining language use in the United States, like English is going down the drain because of this change. And my response to that is English and languages that are alive are always changing. Time will change everything. And the only languages that don't change are languages that no one uses anymore. So
it's interesting, too. I mean, just thinking about the difference between American English and British English, however we sound, we're speaking a North American variety of English.
Yeah. So I'm really happy to see language change because it shows that the community that's speaking that language is alive and vibrant and growing. And so that's basically my response to people who have this idea that English should always be spoken the same way. And it really shouldn't.
Has what you've discovered doing this research been emotional for you or changed how you see your own relationship to your home in Kansas? Just as someone who grew up switching back and forth, the idea that maybe these are becoming one accent?
I'm really happy to see it. Again, going back to the community thing, it's just showing that people in Kansas are growing to accept the people that might look or sound a little bit different than they do. And so it's really exciting to see Kansas being this growing, vibrant place.
What will you look into next? I mean, do you still have questions about how language is changing in and around your hometown of Liberal, Kansas?
I'm still trying to figure out what I should ask. So hopefully as I start graduate school, I'll be able to think of other good questions I could ask about what's happening in Liberal.
Well, Trevin Garcia, thank you so much. Trevin is a linguist with us from K-State, where he's been working on the Kansas Speaks project. I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we're going to get a little bit more Missouri in here with a people's history of the Lake of the Ozarks. Stay tuned. So the Lake of the Ozarks is a really popular tourist spot this time of year, and it's huge, as in physically huge. But there was a time when no such lake existed, and that lasted until 1931. That's when the man-made lake was built. The story of how it got there is more dramatic than you might realize. So a couple of Ozarkians have documented that story in a new book, The People's History of the Lake of the Ozarks. Kent Van Landit, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. And Dan William Peek, hello to you, too.
Thanks.
So you guys, before we get into the story of the Ozarks, I want to hear your personal stories so we can understand a little bit about where your curiosity and interest come from. You went to high school together, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, we're both from Versailles, went to high school there, and I've lived in that general area all my life.
Now, Kent, you're speaking right now. I'm going to stick with you for a second. Your career work, most of it is working as a sociologist and planner for the state of Missouri.
That's true. And in that activities, a lot of it was in terms of economic development. And the Lake of the area, Ozarks area, is so unique compared to any place in the United States where you had a private corporation made a gigantic lake, and it was open to the public. And public could buy land up to the waterfront, which is really unusual. And that was what really opened the area up is for future development.
Okay, explain that a little more. We're going to get to Dan's relationship with the lake in just a minute, but I want to stick with this because it does sound unusual. And I guess when people know that there's been a man-made lake, there's kind of an assumption that this was a public project, but that's not the case here.
That's true. This was not a WPA project. It was not a Corps of Engineers project. It went from the development of a Union Electric power company in St. Louis, looking for a place to build a water-powered dam. And this resulted from a Federal Water Act that had passed just before that time. And they ended up choosing the area on the Osage River to build the dam. And they were really not in the land development idea, any of that. They were just going to build this power dam to dam up the Osage River.
To turn on the lights in St. Louis.
Right. Basically to serve the St. Louis metro area. Because uniquely, that dam did not serve the rural area around central Missouri. Most of that power went straight to the St. Louis area.
Okay, so take me back, though, to what that area was like before there was a lake there. The culture, the ecology.
The lake area is Missouri, hilly, Ozarks, fairly country, kind of what people think of the country hillbilly. The people did not have electricity at that time. There were not any roads. There were trails. They traveled by foot, horse, or on a wagon.
Or mule, right?
Right. Mules were used a lot for work. And their education was at a country school. And those schools were staggered out through small communities. The area really only had four major towns along the Osage River, which were Tuscumbia, Bagnell, Lynn Creek, and Warsaw. And the other towns in that area were along the Rock Island Railroad, which essentially were Versailles and Eldon, the two bigger towns, and then Stover had a depot. So people that were very poor, they lived off the land, and the only real farming area would have been in the river bottom where there could have been some farming area.
There's something, okay, so I brought up mules because you write in this book about that people in the Ozarks actually had a really special relationship with mules.
Yes, mules were recognized as hardworking animals, reliable, stubborn, but people could farm with them and knew how to live off the land because that's essentially what they did.
And then you also write about a special relationship with fire in terms of how people lived off that land.
Yes, it was a tradition to burn off the woods every winter, about three reasons: to kill bugs, to get the brush burned down so it didn't get too much underbrush, and it was just kind of the process to get the land ready for every year because there's very little dirt, so what they could get from that process allowed them to do something next year in that area.
So how much does the culture that you've been describing here affect what happened once this project to build a lake started getting underway?
The local culture was impacted in two ways. This project started in 1929, right about the time of the Depression. And you can talk to older people, and we were able to interview people that said there was not a depression in that area because the construction of the dam employed about 4,000 people on any given day. Union Electric, in their records, said that they employed over 20,000 people. So therefore, people could find jobs there. Plus, railroads were wanting a lot of ties to build a railroad. Their timber was used for making railroad ties, and that was another big source of income. So those people, even though it was pretty much a cashless society and they lived off the land, there was a way for them to make a living and subside at that time.
So where does Dan, I want you to jump in here. What is the story of the Ozarks pre-lake, mean to you?
Well, as Kent said, we grew up around there, so we knew a lot of people who actually had lived through the building of Bagnell Dam and the creation of the lake. So, and I'm a hillbilly, you know. I mean, so, you know, I play the banjo. I like moonshine. You know, all that stuff that it is stereotypical.
No, go on. Tell me more.
So, our relationship, I think, with the lake, we grew up after. If you don't mind, Kent, I'll give away our ages. We were born in 1945, so the lake had been there for 14 years when we were born. But as we were growing up, it was just kind of always there, you know.
And but it was new.
It was new, and it was developing. At the time that I became more aware of it, which was around the end of the 1950s, there was just starting to be a kind of a coalition of forces that were going to bring it into the modern era. Up to that point, there really hadn't been that much development, but you had a group.
What was it like then?
Without the development?
Yeah.
It was kind of isolated. I mean, it was small lot development. That's what the Cyrus Crane Wilmore from St. Louis had bought the shoreline from Union Electric in 1945. And his idea was a small lot development of 50 feet of lakefront, 50 to 100 feet back, and then you built your little cabin on it. And Joy and I, my wife and I, live in one of these small lot developments. And so that was the idea, was that would be the way that it would be would come about. And at the time that we were, the early time that we were involved with it or were living there, that's pretty much what you saw. It was small lake cottages, small boats. My wife and I have I think it's a 23-foot chaparral open bow. And now you see these 40-foot ocean-going vessels on the lake. So that would be a big difference right there. It was mostly seen in the 50s as a place to go for fishing and hunting and that sort of thing. Lee Mace's wife, Joyce, said that they didn't start their Ozark Opry shows until 9 o'clock back in those days because everybody was out on the lake.
So Lee Mace, this is a guy who you performed with, actually.
I did. I played in Lee Mace's Ozark, Lee Mace's Hillbilly Hootenanny when I was 18. But he was part of that whole group that I was starting to talk about, the young entrepreneurial types down at the lake. There was Lee, a guy named Jim Franklin Sr., Al Elam, who plays a big role in this, and just a group of younger people. They were all under 40 at the time. And they were the first ones locally to recognize that the lake could be a commercial fulcrum, you know, that they could actually profit from figuring out what people wanted to do.
What people wanted to do on a lake in Missouri?
Yeah, exactly. Or on a lake anywhere, I guess. Because it was them, and then franchise businesses started coming.
But wait, before we get to the next stage, I mean, for people who aren't from here, and maybe like a lot of our listeners probably have no idea who Lee Mace is.
So
can you talk to me a little bit more about this group of people you're talking about realizing that there was commercial opportunity in the lake? What did they do?
Well, Lee was the first one to, in my opinion, was one of the first ones to recognize this. He and his wife had something called the Ozark Mountain Square Dancers, and they were hired by Nashville, by WSM, to be on the Grand Ole Opry. So they were the square dancers. You can still see them nowadays. They're actually were pretty well known. And they had a national following, that kind of thing. But Lee decided to come back to Osage Beach and start up his own music show, which was Lee Mace's Ozark Opry. So he, and he was very successful. By 1960, he had his own auditorium. Fellow entrepreneurs had started up the Bank of the Lake of the Ozarks, which is still there. It's the central bank of the Lake of the Ozarks now. So, as I say, there was this group of what Kent calls champions, who what do you say, a positive something?
Champions are really people in a community, and you'll see this other places too, that take hold and develop for the total area, not just for their own business or what they're doing, but kind of that idea, we'll get together, we want to make the area stronger.
Right.
And you'll see that in a lot of areas. There'll be four or five people that are kind of leading the parade, bringing other people along and helping them for the good of the whole community. And that's what these four guys really were known for back in the 50s and 60s, of making the lake area known to everybody for a lot of different options to do, whether it's for entertainment, to just get away, whether to for water sports or whatever. It's kind of, here's my area, I'm selling it, and please come.
You know, I guess we've jogged already pretty quickly into this period where we're, you know, 15, 20 years along since the lake was created. But, I mean, before we talk about what's changed since the period that you're describing, what happened? I mean, how did the local community even react to the idea of a lake going in here to begin with?
Well, let me fill in. There's real story between 1930, when the dam was completed, and the 50s. A lot of things were happening nationally. The area was really, in the 30s and 40s, only popular in terms of, like, a few people would come down to hunt and fish and that type of thing. And there was two world wars going on. A lot of the young men were in service. You had a lot of young women that came to the Kansas City area and worked in what was called the defense plants, making products for the military. So the area did not have quite the draw at that time. And then in the 40s, late 40s, you had people going to Fort Leonard Wood from all over the United States. Fort Leonard Wood is not very far from Lake of the Ozarks. And they would take weekend leaves coming to the lake. So you had people from all over the United States seeing that area. People that were working in the cities were starting to get maybe a Saturday off so they could kind of come down on weekends. So that's transitioned over that time until the late 40s. And then in early 50s, people started recognizing it from the, especially Kansas City area, St. Louis area, and Iowa, coming down there for whether they wanted to hunt and fish, whether they want to take a week vacation down there. And that's when you started to see the growth start. And what happened to cause it to continue was, once they were down there for a week, well, they wanted some place to be besides in the cabin, because cabins were not really very large. So they would start looking for restaurants and maybe a grocery store and maybe a place to buy souvenirs. And then all of a sudden, you know, they were down there and they got a scratch on their arm and they needed a stitches or something. Well, they need medical care, so then that demanded medical care.
So this is all a story of growth. Were, I mean, as far as how the local community experienced it, was there also a piece of that that was loss of something that was there before, loss of, I mean, just loss of ownership in some way?
Well, the what we'll call the old timers had already lost, because their land and their little communities were inundated with the water. They were no longer there.
And so they lost land in just the construction of the
right,
lake.
Right, in the lake. And so some of them moved outside of the area. And some started to realize, hey, these people are coming down here. Maybe I can make some money off of them. You know, knowing the area, they say, okay, they'd be hunting guides or fishing guides.
But it seems like just the experience of a lot of people losing land would create some resentments. Or just, how did this all go down?
Yeah, well, that resentment is still...
Yeah,
evident. I mean, when we were writing this book, and remind me to go back and tell you about the Kansas City connection to the lake. The impetus for the lake actually started here with the Kansas City Joint Stock Land Bank, but there's still a sense of resentment. They call themselves true locals. Kent and I are true locals, you know, because our families go back way beyond when the lake was created by the impoundment. And there's still that idea of us and them, you know, the newcomers and the true locals, it's just barely below the surface sometimes. So there is, and it might be that it's passed along generationally, you know. In other words, they took my land, you know, and I had to move into town and get a job, you know.
How did that happen? Did they just, was it?
Oh, well, that's
eminent domain, or
this is why we should go back a little bit. The dam originates with two Kansas City guys, with Ralph W. Street, who's a lawyer and real estate developer, and Walter P. Cravens, who is the president of the Kansas City Joint Stock Land Bank. You can still see the building, by the way. He built a magnificent building in 1923, and it's on 10th Street. I think it's 15 10th or something. Library District, if that sounds. But so they got together, and Street had always had this idea, or since 1912 at least, had this idea of building a dam on the Osage River and creating this lake, but it was all for hydroelectric power. Cravens had access to the assets of the Joint Stock Land Bank. He got into a lot of trouble. He did time, you know, but he transferred about $1 million, and the plan was to trade. We'll go down to the Ozarks. We'll tell these people in the Ozarks that we'll give them land in Kansas or Missouri that's actually farmable, and that way they won't mind giving us the property they have. Well, there's a little miscalculation there. So when they started to meet resistance, well, let me keep the story straight here, and it's all in the book, but Cravens was going to provide the financing. Street had apparently been down there before, and as it happened, they picked the perfect spot to do it because it was the right place on the river, and the local population was not organized. You know, there was no political or civic organization that would enable them to rise up and say, hey, we're not going to allow this to happen. Eventually, because Cravens went to jail and, you know, the Kansas City Joint Stock Land Bank, like all the land banks, failed. Union Electric then bought it and started evicting people.
You know, Kent, you also have some information about how people responded just to the news about what was possibly going to happen to them in their land, that not everyone even believed it was possible that they could lose their land.
Well, sure. I mean, when you're very poor and you've lived in that area, haven't seen any major construction. First, the people hear the dam was going to be built, and they said, well, yeah, that'll take forever and if it works. And then people were like, say, 30 miles upstream, you know, kind of hear about it, but say, well, something down there is not going to impact them. And then some never believed it would hold water. They didn't think the water would get that high. So those people were really in disbelief and, you know, really hardly accepted the idea that there would be that type of thing until they finally were taken off of their property. You know, their property had been purchased and they were, you know, made to leave, and that caused some of those challenges. And again, this was very sparsely populated area, and there were a lot of little communities around there. Some communities would be gone, some communities would still be there. That area did not have what you would call bigger towns, and it doesn't now. Today, in 2018, there is not any town within that four-county area that is larger than 5,000. But you got an area that functions like a metropolitan area with all of the services, all of the different job varieties.
So, but you've said that people, that this initial incident of people being pushed off their land for the construction of the Lake of the Ozarks, even though so much has changed since then, that the resentment still persists.
Yes, it does. And you were right to mention eminent domain, because this is back in the 20s, before there was any real government regulation. So they were able to, it's rumored that Cravens had a deal with a Jackson County judge, so they were able to use eminent domain to get the people off the land. But what they did is Street sent a crew down there with $5 bills in their pocket, and they went from house to house and said, we'll give you a $5 bill for a three-year option on your property. So then imagine the surprise of the mountaineer when somebody knocked on his door or her door and said, we want to exercise the option on your property. And some people did take Cravens up on the deal and, you know, got farmland in Kansas in exchange for their land. So it was an interesting thing, but the resentment still is there.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman talking with the authors of a new book, The People's History of the Lake of the Ozarks. If you've spent a lot of time on or around the lake and it means something to you, you can call us up and talk about it, whether it's the change you've noticed or the big question that you have at 816-235-2888. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. My guests are Kent Van Landit and Dan William Peake. They are the authors of a book called The People's History of the Lake of the Ozarks. Hi again, you guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Why do you call it The People's History? As opposed to what?
Well, this is really, our book is about the change of people. It's not a history like this building was here, here's this building was built in 1890. It's what happened to the people, and that it is so unique, even nationwide, to have this facility privately owned. People can use it, and there's some people that choose to participate fully. There are people maybe live 10 miles to the lake and don't go there once a year. So it's about those lifestyles, how it changed from basic, very poor, rural people to the diversity you have in a metropolitan area with different jobs, different levels of education, different amounts of income, careers, ideas of the future.
We were talking earlier in the show about the Lake of the Ozarks you guys grew up on in the 50s and how it's changed from there is something we still haven't talked about. Can you get into that with me a little bit, Dan?
Sure. We stopped about 1960 there. And
With a community of small lakefront properties,
small
little cabins
lots.
And things. Yeah.
Right. And then, so there was development then after that. Harold Koppler, who owned the Sage Park Plaza in St. Louis, and a guy named Burton Duenke, developed these luxury resorts, Tantara and the Lodge Four Seasons, which changed a lot of the nature of tourism there. Also, the general decision in the 60s and 70s was that they wouldn't sell the lake so much as they would sell it some kind of exotic thing. There was a place called Max Ellen's Reptile Garden. There was the Aquarama where boys and girls wearing flesh-colored suits would fight underwater monsters, you know. That went on from 64 to 73, I think. So the idea was to sell exoticism and that kind of thing. That went on through the 70s. It wasn't until 1998. See, there are two sides to the lake. There's the Kansas City side and the St. Louis side, and they're actually known that way.
Huh. You
know, the west side is the Kansas City side, and the east side is the St. Louis side. And they were not connected to get to from one side to the other, to get from where our Sunrise Beach over to Osage Beach, you'd have to drive all the way around the lake. In 1998, they built what they call a community bridge. It's a toll bridge, but it takes you from Sunrise Beach over to Osage Beach, which are the kind of epicenters of,
I'm just curious, like, just culturally, is there a big difference between the St. Louis side and the Kansas City side?
I would say so. I first noticed, I told Ken about this, I said, you know, you can't buy a St. Louis paper on the Kansas City side. You can't track one down. Now, recently in Osage Beach, you started to be able to get Kansas City. Did you have something, Kent?
Well, I was saying that the difference that we would hear, the west side, which locally we call the Kansas City side, it was more of a laid-back and slower routine. The east side was, hurry up, go get on the water, go water ski, hurry up, we got to go eat, that type of thing. There is a definite different style, and the things that serve those people are serving those types of styles. So there is actually living experiences to show the difference between the east side and west side, which kind of just really happened.
So Ozarks natives are telling us that Kansas City is more laid back than St. Louis, and that's speaking very strongly to my local pride. But let's hear from some of our callers, because we don't have a lot of time, and people have some interesting stuff to share. Bill in Lenexa, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good morning.
Hi, what do you want to share?
Yeah, my question is, my wife and I have a cabin at Truman Lake near Warsaw, and I was curious as to what the relationship between Truman Lake is to Lake of the Ozarks, and why do you think that the Truman Lake area hasn't developed like the Ozarks have in terms of tourism and growth?
Let's hear from Kent on that.
Well, there's one really simple answer. The Truman Lake is a Corps of Engineers lake, which is, does not allow development on the shoreline and that type of thing. So people can go there to fish and enjoy the water and that, but they cannot live on the shoreline and function in the way that they can on Lake of the Ozarks. And that's really what you will see in almost all core lakes. They don't allow that close development to the actual water.
Let's talk to Mike in South Kansas City. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, first I just wanted to answer one of your questions. The St. Louis side is the snob side.
Now we're getting it.
Yeah.
Right.
This guy must be a true local.
No, St. Louis looks down on Kansas City, and they continue that at the lake.
But anyway, as you can hear, we do not do that to them.
My question is, was when I was a kid, back in the 50s, the people from Kansas City that went down there, they drove 50 Highway, which was a two-lane death trap. Yep. Then you get, I don't know what at that time, whether, you know, like 5 Highway, that's the west side again,
right.
Kansas City side, 5 Highway. What do they remember about the development of this, the condition of roads when they first remembered, and they've probably seen things change dramatically.
Yeah.
I'm going to hang up.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Well, yes, yeah, so Highway 5 and being in Versailles, that's what some of us would do on weekend because the highways came through the middle of the town, like Versailles and Eldon. We as locals would go up there on Saturday and watch all the traffic coming down. Look at all those people going to the lake. And it was a very crooked, narrow two-lane road. A lot of traffic accidents in those years. And, you know, that's what we would see in people all the way down to Camdenton. The road was very narrow, very crooked, and very slow traveling.
Was it paved back then?
Yes, it was paved in probably in the 40s. And it was a challenge.
The idea that the locals and tourists would use different, even infrastructure, travel different roads, is super interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, the whole thing is interesting. What happened in the late 70s and 80s through the 21st century is they started building condos. You know, and I asked several of our the people we interviewed, why did they do that? I mean, why didn't they take the Branson path and, you know, become an entertainment site? Well, they didn't want that. They wanted to have a fairly stable population.
Let's talk to Patty in Overland Park, who has a really, like, surprising connection to this whole history of the Lake of the Ozarks. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Tell us your story.
Thanks for having me on. My father was the son of an attorney who worked with the land bank. I don't know how closely, and I don't know how much trouble he got in, but they were invited to come down before the lake was created and stay in the hotel that would be demolished by the water the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather, grandmother, and my father and uncle stayed down there and were told that the trees, they didn't know what to do with them. So the trees got chained to the ground. All this mass of trees that would be in the way of the lake got chained to the ground.
By who? And wait, who chained the trees to the ground?
I don't know, but in order to, maybe it was Corps of Engineers, I don't know, but in order to make the lake not have big old trees sticking up in it, they had to do that.
That's wild.
And,
Patty.
And it was an interesting time because the next morning after breakfast, they took their luggage, went up to the top of a hill, and watched the lake created.
Well, and it looks like Kent has some insight into that moment.
Yes, that was done periodically or all through the area at certain water lines. And again, it's not Corps of Engineers. That was part of Union Electric's job. They would hire men to go out and cut down all the trees up to a certain level so they would be way below the water line, a note of interest, many years later as the chains rusted, you could be boating and see a tree pop up.
Well, our time is up, as you can hear, but Dan William Peake, Ken Van Landit, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Their book is called The People's History of the Lake of the Ozarks. Could be good reading material this 4th of July. And that's a wrap. If you missed our earlier conversation about a new accent in liberal Kansas, you can hear it online at kcur.org/centralstandard. This conversation will be there too. Tomorrow, we'll be back with a show on DNA testing. Has access to information in your genetic code changed things for you? This episode of Central Standard was produced by Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.